ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we'll be treated to the first part of an extended and friendly conversation between Stephen C. Meyer and Michael Shermer, based on Meyer's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Their conversation was produced originally for Shermer's Skeptic podcast, where he regularly promotes both naturalistic evolution and atheism, which makes this cordial interchange refreshingly different and most informative.
Okay, my guest today is Stephen C. Meyer, the famous intelligent design theorist. His book is Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Stephen received his PhD from the University of Cambridge in the philosophy of science. He directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle and authored the New York Times bestseller, Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell. And this is sort of the third volume of his trilogy in building his arguments for there being an intelligent mind behind the cosmos. I'm skeptical. And so he and I go back and forth on at least a dozen different major issues in which I push back on all of them. And he has, of course, rebuttals because there's nothing he hasn't heard from any of us. So to that extent, it's a phenomenal conversation, talking about everything, physics and biology and consciousness, morality, why there's something rather than nothing, and information theory and the laws of physics and the mathematical universe and on and on and on. It's a phenomenal conversation on the biggest questions of all. And the ultimate one, is there something behind it all, something like a God or an intelligent designer, a mind? Well, to find out the answer, give this a listen. Thanks for listening. All right, Stephen Meyer, here it is. The Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Well, all right. You and I have done debates over the years many times, and we're not going to do that today. Let's just have a conversation. Let's just talk about, the big questions. And the problem with debate, and I'm tending probably never going to do them again because, people are just trying to win, and it's more tribal and it becomes more political in that sense. And I find that not so useful. So let's just see what kind of headway we can make. We can just leave off the table. You're trying to convert me or I'm trying to convert you. We're not even going to do that. We're just going to talk about the big issues.
our mutual friend, Brian Keating, told me you wished I were. It would go secular. So,
but oh, well. We
probably both feel the same way. We wish everyone had our worldview. But I've had some really nice debates with you and with Michael Ruse. And one thing that I have felt is that anyone who takes these big questions seriously is a friend, and that there's this kind of kinship between people who are interested in these things. And I read an article over the weekend by someone who said that the great thing about the new atheists, and this was a young Christian writer, was that they actually took religion seriously enough to make an argument about it,
Yeah, that's right. So, well, we should take religion seriously. I mean,
we have that in common.
It's an important institution and so on. Well, before we get into it, just for my listeners that don't know much about you, give us a little bit of a potted autobiography of where you grew up and your education and where you work now and what.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm from the Seattle area originally. I went to university as an undergrad at Whitworth University in Eastern Washington. It was a small liberal arts college affiliated with a Presbyterian tradition. I majored in geology and physics and took a minor in philosophy on the side. After graduation, I worked for 4 years in the oil industry. I was doing seismic digital processing for a big oil company in Texas. And I got a Rotary scholarship my last year to head off to England and did first a master's in the history of science and then a PhD in the philosophy of science at Cambridge. My PhD dissertation and study was in the field of origin of life biology. So it was a very interdisciplinary topic. And after I got out, I came back to Whitworth and taught there for a number of years. In 96, 6 years into my tenure, I helped start the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. In 2002, came full-time, resigned my position at Whitworth and came full-time to work with Discovery. Since which time I've been engaging folks like Michael Shermer and Michael Ruse and writing books and articles, and had a role in the formation of the Intelligent Design Research Program.
Yeah, I should say, point out to my listeners, and you mentioned this in your book, that not all scientists take your hypothesis, not just yours, but the other intelligent design theorists, very seriously. I think in part, particularly with older scientists, they're remembering young Earth creationists of the 1950s and 60s, people like Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris and the Gish Gallop and all that stuff, and none of that panned out at all, as even hardly useful to even look at. This is not your father's creationism. I should tell people that this is far more serious. This, you know, these are not just published by Christian publishers. Your book is HarperCollins. I mean, and same thing with many of your colleagues. These are mainstream trade or university presses that are publishing your works. And you know, I have a shelf full of books by professional philosophers and scientists addressing your claim. So. You know, you are getting a hearing. It's being taken seriously. And again, this is not your father's creationism. So it's worth discussing. And as well, you know, I've had conversations on the kind of sociology of science and knowledge in general. And, you know, there's kind of a split in the atheist skeptical community about belief in God and religion. And, you know, Dan Dennett's argument, well, I, you know, of course, I'm an atheist, but I believe in belief. I believe that other people need to believe or want to believe. And that may be true for some people, but I suspect not for you. You're not claiming this is my truth and you have your truth, or, you know, Noma, you know, you have your world and we have our world. You're making an argument that's empirical, that's a scientific-based argument, that it's really true, not just mythically true or psychologically true.
Right, right. True for me, true for you, true. Yeah. Or Freudian in the sense that man did not create God, but God did not create man, but man created the concept of God. I'm arguing for more than the concept of God, although the concept of God functions as an explanatory hypothesis. And I argue that because it does provide such compelling explanation of key facts we have about biological, physical, and cosmological origins, we have good reason to believe that the concept is also referring to a reality. In the same way, when we, as in theoretical physics, where we posit an unobservable in order to explain something we can observe, when we find that that unobservable entity, whether a quark or a force or a field, provides the best explanation of the observables, we hold that that postulation as a truth pointer. It's pointing to something that's a reality.
So when we think about how science works, since you're positing a scientific hypothesis to be tested in a way, that testing, that falsification, that Popperian falsification is part of it, but not the only part of it. There's also kind of a Bayesian, you know, moving in the direction of positive evidence that we can accumulate, in which our confidence grows or shrinks, depending on changing our priors as the new evidence comes in and so forth. But there's also then a social aspect that I like to think about is the kind of consensus science. You know, has science reached a consensus or not? So like when I started college in 1971, the Big Bang Theory had largely ousted the steady state theory. There was a lot of consensus from most scientists and labs, from, you know, cumulative independent lines of evidence to point to that and not the other one. And so the Big Bang Theory kind of won out and almost nobody, I presume nobody, could probably find somebody that embraces steady state theory today. But nevertheless, there's consensus on that. Now, if you are...
Well, Hoyle held on to it to the bitter end, but even Gold and Bondi relinquished that fairly quickly. Yeah. His co-formulators of the theory. Yeah.
So if the accumulated evidence you present in your book along these three major lines of inquiry were true, or that, you know, it's substantial evidence, wouldn't most scientists who work in these areas read your book and go, yes, I think that's probably correct? And I don't see that happening. I mean, your book just came out, so maybe that's not fair for your book, but the arguments that you guys have been making since the 90s have been around. So just take Brian Keating's podcast. He read your book, He knows all the cosmology that you present in there. He understands it. And so when I had him on my podcast, I asked him, so did you convert? are you a theist now? And to be fair, Brian's not an atheist like in the Dawkins mode. He's not militant about it at all. You know, he's not something he's trying to do. So, you know, here's what he said, roughly speaking here, without my playing it. I'm using the YouTube transcript. You know, as I read this as a cosmologist, and I find oftentimes, like with William Lane Craig in particular, that it's sort of this, it borders on the confirmation bias. It borders on manipulation of evidence to support a conclusion. And that conclusion always ignores the existence of alternative cosmologies, of which there are many. And in this article for the cover issue of Skeptic, so this article he did for us, I want to flesh out the fact that it is by no means settled that there was a Big Bang. Now, listen, I said a Big Bang because it seems to me that if there were multiple Big Bangs, that doesn't give more support for a creator than it might give less support for a creator. Anyway, and he goes off on there. And so, for example, in this article, he talks about inflationary cosmology and the different versions of that. And then this bouncing cyclical models that look something like that. you know, he talks about these kind of multiple Big Bangs. And he says, I'll just read this portion. So there's this one conformal cyclical cosmological model claims the universe endlessly cycles through consecutive eons of time in which, as Roger Penrose described it, the distant future of a particular eon becomes identified with the Big Bang of the subsequent eon. In so-called bouncing models, the cosmos rebounds after a contracting phase, ushering in a new expansion. According to Steinhardt and Turok, this cycle iterates on trillion-year timescales. So, at the very whether that turns out to be true or not, who knows? But the point is that we don't know enough to know that your alternative explanation is the one we should take. Maybe we just don't know, and there's these other alternatives.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot to say about that. It's a great question. First of all, there may be confirmation bias in the scientific community that would prevent a majority consensus congealing around something as provocative as I'm proposing. We do know that there is a default rule of method known as methodological naturalism that says that if you're going to be a scientist, you have to explain everything by reference to purely materialistic causes, whether you're talking about even including things like the origin of the universe, the origin of life, its fine-tuning, or the origin and nature of human consciousness. And so if that's taken as normative, then no amount of evidence for creative intelligence could move a group of people who already hold that as normative. That's one thing to say. Second thing to say is I don't accept the premise of the question that these evidences and are not moving professionals who are working in the fields in which I'm talking. I've got some fantastic book endorsements, including a Nobel laureate in physics, and from leading scientists. But also going back to the 1980s, you had books like God and the Astronomers by Robert Jastrow. You had the very dramatic public conversion of Alan Sandage, who cited evidences from cosmology as a factor in his intellectual conversion from materialism to theism. And so I don't think we can make an argument one way or another from the sociology of science alone. There could be confirmation bias within the field, and there are plenty of people who have gone the opposite direction of that you indicate. As to Brian, he's an interesting guy. He describes himself as an agnostic who wrestles with God, but he clearly is a theist. He's a practicing conservadox Jewish fellow, mm-hmm. And he's told me, maybe I don't know what he's told you, but he's told me that he finds the argument from design and biology quite persuasive. So, you know,
but not cosmology.
Interesting. But let's talk about the cosmology, because what I argue is that the evidence has theistic implications. Obviously, there are new models being proposed all the time, but I address the cyclical and oscillating models in cosmology head on. There's very powerful work critiquing those models, going back to Alan Guth, who showed that with each successive cycle in an oscillating universe, you have an accumulation of entropy. You have to, because there's energy blowing the universe apart. And so to get it, the next cycle has less energy available to do work. You've got an entropy buildup. And therefore, if you'd had an infinite number of cycles, eventually you're going to damp out like a bouncing ball. And if the universe was infinitely old, we would have reached that state of nullifying equilibrium a long time ago. Ergo, the universe couldn't be infinitely old. Ergo, even on an oscillating universe model, you have a beginning. Now, the newer cyclical models have been proposed by Steinhardt and Penrose posit some mechanism of, with each cycle, of reducing entropy, of going back to a highly ordered state. But the mechanisms have no specificity, and they're contrary to everything we know about physics in our universe. And this is where, you know, just in our discussions, I love the whole, you know, Skeptic magazine, and I know Brian's got a piece expressing skepticism about the multiverse. But there is a form of naturalism now, which I call in the book exotic naturalism. It's a form of supernatural materialism where things are posited beyond this universe in order to explain the key features we have about the key indicators we have of a beginning to this universe, as well as the fine tuning of the universe, as well as the deep mystery of the origin of life. And I think there's a tremendous basis for skepticism about these exotic forms of naturalism, where we're talking about whether we're talking about multiverses in the sense that are invoked to explain the fine tuning, or whether we're talking about an infinite cycle of previous universes to which we have no empirical access by definition, or whether we're talking about Hawking's notion of imaginary time, or you know, even folks positing space alien designers to try to explain the evidence for design and the digital informational properties of living systems. I mean, no less a personage than Francis Crick posited panspermia with a design coming from some imminent intelligence within the cosmos, because he recognized the extreme difficulty of explaining the origin of life within this cosmos. Kunin has posited the multiverse as an explanation for the origin of the first life. So I think there's a, you know, You've made your bread and butter as a skeptic, and rightly so. Many of the things you're skeptical about, I'm skeptical about. But I'm suggesting that there is an appropriate skepticism about these extremely and increasingly convoluted materialistic models that are invoking things beyond this universe, beyond any possible observational confirmation, as explanations for the key features that I'm addressing in the book. So I'm not skeptical about modern cosmology. I think the facts, every indicator we have in cosmology points to a beginning. Of course, we can create imaginative scenarios of multiple cycles before this one, or other verses out there, multiverses, gabillions of them. But I think it's reasonable to be skeptical about them and to weigh whether they really provide a better explanation than the single and more simple postulate in the Occam's razor sense of a transcendent intelligence.
Yeah, I want to dig down into that methodological naturalism, but I had one more example. Since you said Brian said, Brian was encouraged by the biological arguments for intelligent design, but that's not his field. So I found a review of your book on BioLogos. I know you know those guys. And here I'm reminded of Christopher Hitchens' line about, if you hear the Pope say he believes in God today, you think, well, the Pope's doing his job. That's what he's supposed to do. But if you hear that the Pope says he's having some doubts about God today, you think, whoa, maybe I should pay attention here. So, you know, I mean, BioLogos, the, you know, sort of theistic evolutionists or creative evolution, whatever they call themselves now, you would expect them.
Whatever they call themselves. They keep shifting the terminology.
I just did
a long podcast with guy, Jim Stump.
So oh, you I'm, did? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Interacting with all the different points on the ideological compass here.
Well, then you can respond to this. I'm sure you've seen this review by Daryl Falk. I don't know him. Sure. He's a biologist. He says, Mayer's critique of the origin of life and evolutionary biology has significant inaccuracies. For example, discussing the hypothetical RNA world and the origin of life, Mayer writes, quote, to date, scientists have been able to design RNA catalysts that will copy only about 10% of themselves, close quote. He then references a paper from 2001. However, the field has progressed quite well in the past 20 years. For example, in 2014, Robertson and Joyce reported a similar system with a tweak which resulted in 100% effectiveness. They summarized the results with these words, quote, each parental enzyme can give rise to thousands of copies per hour, and each of these copies in turn can do the same, all the while transmitting molecular information across generations. And then he has a discussion about enzymatic reactions and so on. And then he says Meyer goes on to describe a meeting at the New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, which he attended 2016, and this guy was there too. I was at the meeting also. In one sense, I think he's right. The theme in the meeting was that classic gene-based studies of how evolution works were giving a far too narrow picture of how the process of evolution has taken place. There's simply much more to the story than that, which emerges when the focus is on genes. A more holistic approach is required. Meyer summarized the opening talk this way, and quoting you now. In short, neo-Darwinism fails.
Hey, Michael, would it be okay to take these things separately?
Yeah, sure.
Two big subjects.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
The RNA thing.
Do the first one. Yeah.
The developmental biology issues. I addressed the Joyce paper in a response to my book that was published in the Times Literary Supplement. And basically what they did was they had two pre-made halves, which they fused together. Okay. And so this was not a significant increase in biological information. And there was a huge amount of to the extent that they got any replicatory or biological relevance out of their RNA world simulation, there was an incredible input of, or a significant input of information from the investigator. The investigator has to sequence the bases in the RNA to get any resemblance of function out of it. So these experiments are not simulating undirected evolutionary change. And Jim Tour, who knows a whole lot more about organic synthesis than Daryl Falk, has been stripping the bark off of these guys in Origin of Life research, pointing out that they're starting with purified reagents. They're implementing an intelligently designed recipe where they combine specific chemicals at particular temperatures, cool them at just the right time, remove the byproducts so that we don't get interfering cross reactions. This field really has made no progress apart from simulations that involve extensive investigator interference, where the investigator is inputting information. So I'll stand very firmly by my original critique of RNA world, and people who know a lot more about organic chemistry than Daryl Falk are pointing out the very same problems that I am. Falk, by the way, in his review of Darwin's Doubt, acknowledged, and this gets to your question about methodological naturalism. He said that I was absolutely correct that mutation and selection did not have the creative power to generate the new information needed for something like the Cambrian explosion, and that the newer post-neo-Darwinian models, which I also critiqued in that book, were also inadequate to the task. His reason for holding on to a general evolutionary framework was his affirmation of methodological naturalism. So the biologist wasn't critiquing the biology in that case. He had a confirmation bias, a pre-commitment to methodological naturalism. Now go on with the stuff.
Fair enough.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
Too many things keep in my head at one time.
Fair enough.
The London meeting.
The only reason I'm reading this is because
gene-based evolution.
This guy, premises his review of your book saying, I'm a born-again evangelical Christian. I accept Jesus. I do believe God operates in the world and miracles and so on.
Right, but we've been having a pretty good fight with those guys too, because what they do is they simply baptize a standard evolutionary theory and say that it's some way that it's very easy to reconcile with theism. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but that doesn't absolve them of the need to address the scientific problems with those theories. And as you and I have talked before, I think it's appropriate to be skeptical about neo-Darwinism, and many leading evolutionary biologists are. It was striking to me at that meeting that people were very explicit about the lack of creative power associated with the mutation selection mechanism, and they were there to investigate other possible evolutionary mechanisms that could possibly supplement that creative power. Susan Mazur, who's been part of the Altenburg 16 group and who was one of the voices calling for the meeting, characterized the meeting as a whole afterwards for its lack of momentousness. That it did effectively a good job of explaining the problems, but there weren't really powerful solutions on offer. And Falk's characterization of this as just a matter of gene-based evolution, that my critique was only about gene-based evolution, is really a misrepresentation of what I argued. I argue, yes, it's absolutely the rarity of genes and proteins in combinatorial sequence space is a huge problem for generating not minor modifications to existing genes or proteins, but generating new protein folds. That's one level of the critique I offered. But at a higher level, I looked at the whole problem of the immutability of gene regulatory networks, which is the locus of Davidson's work at Caltech for years. I looked at the importance of in body plan formation of epigenetic and ontogenetic information. These new discoveries about these hierarchies of informational control in life are posing problems for evolutionary developmental biology at every level. It's not just a matter of generating new genes and proteins. So I don't accept his characterization of the narrowness of my critique.
Interesting. But the meeting itself was not proposing what your hypothesis is one of the alternatives table.
But I happen to know about 10 to 15% of the people there were ID people. I mean, we were obviously interested in what was being discussed. You know, people like, for example, Günter Beckley, the German paleontologist who has announced his support for intelligent design, coming from a deep background in evolutionary biology and paleontology.
I guess my point in this thread is, I do wonder, will we ever get to a consensus? Maybe it's 50 years from now, 100 years from now, or will we never reach consensus science because it has metaphysical, even religious overtones, and people just can't make that leap? I mean, are we forever going to? This is going to be a different question than just say Big Bang versus steady state. This is a different kind of animal.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I wrote the book and why I think conversations like the ones that you and I have had over the years are so important, because we may not reach consensus, but as I think you're arguing in your new book, we still should be talking to each other. There needs to be free speech in this country, and having these constructive dialogues where we're not stigmatizing each other and stereotyping each other and all that. And these are the most interesting questions. You know, there was a conference at Baylor 20 years ago called The Nature of Nature.
Yeah, I was there.
And it was raising the question. Yeah, you were there. I think that may have been the first time we met, actually. I think we did our first debate a year or two later at that college in Wisconsin. But these are fantastically interesting questions, and we don't need to be afraid of them. You know, some people come down, nature is a self-existing, self-organizing system. It does not require something external to itself to explain its properties. That's the naturalistic view of you, of Sean Carroll and you and you know, some of the aggressive new atheists, and I know you're not part of that group, but fair enough. You know, that's a viewpoint. That's an interesting viewpoint. The other view is that nature has properties that are pointing to something beyond itself and requires something external to itself in order to explain what we see. And I find, and that's generally a theistic view, but one of the things that I was pointing out in the book is there is a kind of materialistic supernaturalism now. I called it exotic naturalism, where where scientists are feeling the need to posit things beyond our universe in order to explain the properties of the universe, even if they're not willing to consider creative intelligence as a possibility. So we get multiverses, and we get quantum wave functions, and we get, cyclical cycles of expansion and contraction before the Big Bang. But, you know, these questions of ultimate causal origins raise these deeper metaphysical questions. And I think we can have constructive conversations about them. We can evaluate them rationally. One thing I appreciate about Dawkins is he has a great talent for framing issues. And he has this wonderful quote where he says that the universe has exactly the properties we should expect if at bottom there's no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, of course, blind, pitiless indifference is shorthand for strictly materialistic processes. So he's saying materialism as an overarching system of thought can be tested by looking at the properties that the universe has. I agree with that. I think metaphysical hypotheses are testable more in a Bayesian way than in the way we do in the lab, where you put something under, do something under controlled laboratory conditions and try to get replicability. So I appreciate Dawkins is willing to engage a big metaphysical question and say we can evaluate, test it by observations we make of the properties of the universe. I just happen to disagree with Dawkins's ultimate conclusion, and I think that there are key properties of the universe that are much more expected on theism than on naturalism. And three that I mention and develop in the book are that the universe is best we can tell from the empirical evidence had a beginning, that the universe has been finely tuned for the possibility of life from the beginning and soon thereafter, and that at the foundation of life, we have an integrated informational complexity, digital code, complex information processing, storage, transmission system that boggles the mind and points in every way to a designing intelligence, a master programmer for life. So I think those are three things that you would not have expected on a straightforward naturalistic worldview. You wouldn't have expected a beginning, you wouldn't have expected fine-tuning, and you wouldn't have expected digital code at the foundation of life. And one way we know that's not what you would expect is the number of explanatory postulates, pure theoretical postulates that have to be formulated on, to save the appearances from a naturalistic point of view. The multiverse is a great example of that. That naturalism has become more and more convoluted in the sense of epicycles of explanatory entities in order to explain the same things that a single common sense appeal to intelligent design or creative intelligence would explain.
That was Stephen C. Meyer and Michael Shermer, the first of four parts in a conversation on Meyer's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. There'll be more to come, so we invite you to return and to follow us through your podcast app of choice or at idthefuture.com. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.